This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Gus Speth, one of the leading environmentalists in the U.S. over the past 40 years, I want to say. He co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council. He founded the World Resources Institute. He chaired Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality. He's also written a couple of books on the subject. His latest is called America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy, and I highly recommend it. Gus Speth, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. It's good to be here. All those groups did better after I left them.
Oh, I doubt that, but I appreciate the modesty or the stab at modesty, depending on what that was. Let me get to know you a little better. I just saw on the jacket of the book and doing a very preliminary, perfunctory Google search on you that you clerk for Justice Hugo Black after graduating from law school. What was he like?
Hugo Black, an amazing man. I was there in towards the end of his tenure on the court, and he was a very sweet, gentle man, but very determined and very and knew exactly how he wanted the cases to come out and fought hard for them on the court. It was the first year of the Burger Court. And for those who of my vintage might remember that this was an eight-judge court because Nixon couldn't get the ninth judge appointed. Very interesting. So we had some 4-4 decisions and that type of thing. But Black was a great man.
And how involved was he in the drafting? Did you clerks do most of the drafting, or was he one of the primary drafters?
That's a good question. The clerks did a draft under his guidance and instruction, basically, and then he took it and wrote what he wanted, be sure it said what he wanted to say. That's a very funny story. We had a lot of pornography cases around that time, and so we had a theater in the basement. And for Black and Douglas, they didn't have to go because it was all protected by the First Amendment, regardless. The funny part is that Douglas went anyhow and took them all in. Black didn't go.
A lot of people who graduate high in their law school class and are editing the law journal, I assume you're on that, and then go clerk for a Supreme Court justice tend to aspire to being judges or Supreme Court justices themselves. You went a different route. Why?
Well, when I was in law school, I had this thought that we could create a public interest law firm for the environment, and it was new at that time. This was the late 60s, and so we were lucky enough to get a Ford Foundation grant to create the Natural Resources Defense Council right out of law school. And so I was interested in environmental issues, and that took me down that path.
Now, I know Robert Redford's been involved with that for a long time. How'd you get him hooked into that?
Well, he was a natural to add to this board that was being created, and he came in at the very beginning. I think we had an amazing president of the Natural Resources Defense Council who stayed there for close to 40 years, a man named John Adams, and John got a lot of interesting people involved on the board, including James Taylor as well. And now Leonardo DiCaprio. So it's been an interesting board.
Were you always interested in the environment growing up? Were you a bird watcher or a hiker? Or how'd you get involved?
Well, I think part of it was coming out of the 60s. We wanted to, a group of us at the Yale Law School wanted to do something constructive. We thought more constructive than we could be with a traditional firm. My background was in what you might think of as the environment. I mean, I had grown up with a father who took me hunting and fishing on a regular basis, almost certainly on a monthly basis. We would go out, maybe sometimes more often in the summer.
That's big here in Wisconsin, by the way, so I can appreciate that. Then you ended up in the 70s working for Jimmy Carter in his, I was going to say cabinet. I don't know if the Council on Environmental Quality was part of the cabinet, but
we sat on the back row.
All right, so you got in. What was Jimmy Carter like?
I think Jimmy Carter is a great man. He was a very, also like Hugo Black, a very determined man, and I think did he was unquestionably our most environmental president that we've ever had, and did a lot, including protecting the Alaska lands, which was a huge 4-year fight for him. And he was very involved, and people say he was too involved in some of the details. He knew everything about the budget, for example. He knew all the details.
Are you still in touch with him? Do you have any contact with him?
Well, off and on, but nothing substantial. He was kind enough to give a very nice comment on one of my earlier books, and which I greatly appreciated, because that earlier book, which was called Red Sky at Morning, was heir really to a report that we did in the Carter administration called the Global 2000 Report, which was a look ahead from 1980 to 2000, what the world could be like if we didn't respond to some of the emerging environmental resource and population pressures. And we finally finished it in 1980 in the middle of the election campaign, and some of Carter's advisors said, don't put it out because, you know, you're already called Bad News Jimmy by some people. And he said, no, I'm not only going to put it out, we're going to have a big press conference, which I'll appear and promote these conclusions. So I was very proud of him. I don't think it had any effect on the election.
Well, what were some of those conclusions and predictions, Gus Beth?
Well, back then, we knew enough to say that the climate change issue was a serious issue and needed to be addressed in our energy policy. You know, this was over 30 years ago. And, you know, we knew enough back then to say that the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere ought to be capped at no more than 50% above the pre-industrial level. And this, we're going to shoot right past that any day now. I think we foresaw the decimation of the tropical forest the loss of fisheries on a global basis. Population projection was pretty close to accurate. It was basically an effort at looking at the future as in a world in which we didn't address these issues. And, by the year 2000, when it rolled around, most of the important projections in the report had come to pass because we hadn't addressed those issues, still haven't.
That's a tragedy, isn't it? I'm speaking with Gus Speth. He is the author of a new book called America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. He's the co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the founder of World Resources Institute, and as we were just talking about, he chaired Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine, and you are listening to Progressive Radio. I know in this book and perhaps in those studies you were doing back in 1980, that you studied the issue of global warming and predicted that there'd be stronger hurricanes and bigger floods. And lo and behold, we've had stronger hurricanes and bigger floods and a whole mess of other things that scientists have been predicting. I take it you weren't surprised by Sandy then and the flooding that besieged the East Coast.
No, unfortunately not. I mean, the extra heat and the energy, the changing in the in what's going on up in the Arctic, forcing the hurricane to take a sharp left dogleg into New York and New Jersey. You can't say that any of this event was caused by global warming, but it was certainly affected by global warming.
How do you react to the know-nothings in the Republican Party, some on committees of science and the environment, on global warming? Doesn't it just horrify you?
Well, it does horrify me. I think what we are seeing on this issue and others is the result of unintentional doubt mongering. There's some wonderful historians of science that have looked at this, like Naomi Oreskes, who has written this wonderful book called Merchants of Doubt, and she traces the story from smoking, then to secondhand smoking, to acid rain, to global warming. And in every case, it's often the same scientists who are sowing the seeds of doubt and basically poisoning the well, and eventually, and people are so tribal in their attitudes. You know, they don't want to part company with their group, and so it sort of gradually took over the Republican Party, and they're playing to a stacked deck in a way, because in many many Americans, I think, are frustrated. They're clinging to their beliefs that are sometimes challenged by science, and we don't have very good science education. As I mentioned in America the Possible, only about half the people in the country know that the Earth travels around the sun in a year.
Oof.
And so we have this complex of sort of scientific denial and a certain amount of ignorance and a certain amount of fear of what the scientists are going to say. I think 2/3 of the people in the country say that if science were to contradict a particular religious belief that they held, they would reject the science.
Yeah, I think that's where we are right now, belief trumping facts. I'm speaking with Gus Speth. He is the author, as he mentioned, America the Possible, really great book, subtitled Manifesto for a New Economy. He's been a leading environmentalist here in the U.S. for the past 40 years. Actually, you describe yourself in the book as perhaps one of the ultimate environmental insiders, and yet you yourself got arrested last year. Why'd you make that leap?
Well, that was Time Magazine's characterization of me. But I had been, basically in what you might think of as establishment mainstream jobs until about 10 years ago when I started reflecting on the conditions in the country. And it started with looking a hard look at environmental conditions, but, the harder I looked, these environmental issues were linked to social issues and the problems that had been brought forward by Occupy and the problems that had been brought forward by the demonstrations in Madison at the State House. And the particular thing that got me arrested was the stand that we took in Washington to try to bring to a halt this Keystone XL pipeline. It's called the tar sands pipeline that would bring the tar sands from Canada down to the Gulf Coast refineries. And we did manage to slow it up. Obama has put it on the back burner. But now the election's over. We'll see what happens. But I think there are going to be more demonstrations, frankly, on this issue. And I've give my friend Bill McKibben a lot of credit for organizing that. And he's on his multi-state tour and to bring this issue to a broader attention. I think, Bill and I were cellmates. We spent three days together in the central cell block of the D.C. jail.
What was that like?
It was not a place you want to be. we were treated pretty roughly, but no more roughly than the hundreds and hundreds of young black men that we saw trapped in the criminal justice system of D.C. We knew we were going to walk out of there in short order, and we did. A lot of those kids will bounce around in that system for a long time.
Mm, I bet that was an eye-opener.
It was, just to see it. You read about it, but then you see and talk to some of them because we were put in holding cells with leg irons with them for half a day.
I was struck by a line in your book toward the end where you say, there are those of us who've worked for decades to elicit a meaningful response to the existential threat of climate change and who find, after all the effort, only ashes.
We've done nothing. I mean, basically nothing. After all the warnings, there are forces that are pushing our emissions down in part the economy and other things, but not nearly at the rate that we need to decrease emissions. And I take back that we haven't done anything. I mean, Obama has done a few things. He certainly walked away from the issue publicly in the last couple of years and certainly stayed far away from it in the campaign. But I think the auto mileage standards that have been put in place and the efforts that EPA has been making under the Clean Air Act have been quite important and good to have. There aren't nearly enough, though. And we ought to be basically getting out of fossil fuels by mid-century. We should have wound the whole business down by then.
And one of those EPA regulations he overruled, I know, on coal. So.
Yes. No, it's been a very mixed record, and he hasn't been a champion on the issue since it lost in the Senate in 2009.
And on those international agreements, he's been dragging his feet, just as Bush did. He doesn't deny the existence of man-made contributions to global warming, like many in the Republican Party do.
Well, I'm hopeful that the issue's coming back. You see some signs of that, and Sandy's forcing it out into public. It'll be interesting to see what Chris Christie does in the wake of Hurricane Sandy. He has been very bad on the issue so far and took New Jersey out of the northeastern state regulatory approach that was in place.
Well, I think maybe he'll come around. I know Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg have been real good in the wake of Sandy. Listen, I want to get deeper into this book of yours, Gus Beth, America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. We know what's wrong with the country. You talk about, you lay out your vision, and it's important to have a vision. You talk about new values, new motivations, new habits of thought. What are some of those?
Well, I think we're, as a society, we can't wait on values to change, but we have to start trying to change them along with doing other things. Patrick Daniel Moynihan had a great phrase, and he said that the central conservative truth is that values really matter and determine the fate of societies, and culture really matters. But the central liberal truth is that a society can consciously change its values and its culture and save itself. And I think that's what we need to do. There are a lot of things that can promote value change, but as you mentioned, I think we need to move away from this excessive materialism and consumerism. We need to see ourselves as part of nature rather than apart from nature and dominating nature. We need to think in longer terms. A big word, but we have this contemporcentrism in our thinking now, and we need to think about the longer term. And really, the book is about the world that we could build by 2050 for our grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And I've got six now, and that's what really motivates me, frankly.
What is contemporcentrism?
Short-termism, just thinking, we have it. Don't have a terrible problem, don't we? We can't politically. We don't remember what happened a month ago, and our politicians are motivated by the, next election, and our business leaders are motivated even more short-term by the next quarterly report. If we don't find ways to plan for the long term. We'll never deal with these big questions that face the country. We are failing across a broad front, as the book lays out the issues socially, environmentally, politically, and economically. And when you look at all of these problems that we have in all these areas, and I could talk about that at a little more length, but what you have to conclude is that it's the system that's failing. We have a system that is not geared to prioritize people, place, and planet, and that's where we need to change the economy to the point that it really does give priority to people and to place and to planet.
Let's talk a little bit about place, because you talk of the need to relocalize the economy. At the same time, you talk about glocalism, and so I wonder how you reconcile those two things.
Well, there's an easy way to recognize them. You can create a new word, glocalism. I think there are, we are moving towards a sense of global citizenship. I think more and more people have a sense that they belong to an international community, and more and more people have contacts internationally, and I think that's going on. At the same time, it's not only desirable but probably inevitable, given the way energy prices are going to go, that life will become more focused on local communities. We have this problem of throwaway communities now, so it's a good thing to be reviving our sense of community, to be instilling a sense of rootedness and responsibility locally. But it's probably also inevitable that things are going to move in this direction, because we've been living high on the hog energy wise.
No doubt about that. I'm speaking with Gus Speth, who is the author, most recently, of America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. And you spell out this vision, and there are just a lot of neat things in this vision. On top of relocalization, you talk about plenitude, which is a beautiful word in and of itself, plenitude and more equality and more time on our hands and all these fun things, new business models.
Well, it can all be ours if we work on it. I mean, Europe has been, you know, was a good model in a lot of ways. They've kind of, you know, played into the conservative hands here in a sense by creating their own problems with their debt crisis and so on. You know, the European on average work 300 hours a year less than we do. I mean, it's almost like a 4-day work week. And you know, think of what we could do with if we had more time on our hands. You know, we could volunteer. We could invest it in our families. Americans don't take vacations anymore. I mean, it's amazing how the sort of shrinking vacation syndrome that we have. People are depriving their children of that time because they, you know, so many of them are living on the margin. Right. About half the Americans, American families, you know, are paycheck to paycheck right now. And they say they can't raise $2,000 over a 30-day period in an emergency situation. So these problems are all linked up, I think.
How do we get to more equality? How do we get to America the possible?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is to do something that, you know, we haven't done on the progressive side, and that is to all the different progressive communities get out of our silos, come together, build backbone organizations that cut across these issues, develop a common platform, a common infrastructure, get busy building grassroots support and mobilizing people at the community level, at the local level. You know, get out of Washington if you have to, and start mobilizing and be prepared to protest and go to the streets and even get arrested if need be to dramatize issues and bring you know the matter to the attention and we also need to fight for particular things that need doing if we're going to salvage our politics, like campaign finance reform, and saving American journalism. I mean, how many reporters have we lost? A big fraction, frankly, in the last decade or so.
And it's just a field day for the corporations, then, if you got no one covering them. Or it's a field day for the vested interests, especially state by state in the legislatures. These guys are getting away with just taking the money and going to the bank laughing because there are not enough reporters following them. And my friend Bob McChesney and John Nichols have written a lot about this crisis, and it's really, really
troubling. One point they make is that there's a good correlation, a good positive correlation between public support for journalism and democratic success on the Economist Democracy Index. So it doesn't ruin your country to have public support for journalism. It helps people.
Yeah, we need to get there where we're subsidizing journalism in this country because the market is destroying journalism, as it has been for decades, but it's really accelerated. Now, I like what you were saying, Gus Beth, about getting out of our silos. You talk about environmentalists. A lot of environmentalists recognize or share interests with what you call social justice liberals or progressives. But sometimes you suggest that social justice progressives aren't recognizing the commonality that they have or need to have with environmentalists. How do you bridge that?
Well, I think you have to begin, I think, with leaders talking to each other. I think at the local level, at the community level, people do see these issues as more one issue.
And sometimes they're the same people.
Same people. Yeah. And I think, I'm told that when these huge demonstrations occurred around the Capitol in Madison, that it was all the progressive communities coming together. But the national organizations need to start talking to each other. And I think that, the problem is on both sides. I know some of the pro-job, pro-labor groups that work on social justice issues in Washington, they don't have an environmental bone in their bodies. And I have tried, I think it's different for some others, but I have tried to preach to my environmental tribe that they need to embrace the social issues. I mean, how can you, the most basic thing environmental the environmentalism wants to accomplish, I think, in a way, is to get, you know, in this market economy, to get environmentally honest and socially honest prices out there. And you can't do that if you're, you know, basically raising prices on the back of a you know, half the country that feels economically insecure already. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just we need to bring these issues together. And environmentalists have to recognize that basically, you know, they're progressives, they're liberals. Get over it.
Nothing ashamed about that. I'm speaking with Gus Speth. He is one of the leading environmentalists in the United States over the past 40 years. He was one of the founders of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He served in Jimmy Carter's council. He was head of Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality. He's written a couple books on the environmental crisis, and he's got a new book, which is even broader, and it's called America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. Part of this is a chicken and egg problem. You've got corporations with so much power. You have the top 1% or 0.1% with so much power that they have elected, by and large, the Congress that they want and state legislatures that they want. And so wresting power from them, making them change is going to be hard. Making corporations change is going to be hard. You talk about transforming the corporation as one of your visions here of America the Possible. Just on that front, how do you get CEOs to stop doing profit maximization above all?
Well, I think you know, we need a kind of a pincer movement to approach to the corporate sector. One is building a different type of corporation from the ground up. I mean, in there, it's happening with co-ops, the whole co-op movement, the credit union movement, the efforts for public-private hybrids of different type and profit, not-for-profit hybrids, social enterprises. This is happening all across the country. And on the other hand, you know, we need to start putting into the political dialogue the measures which would rein in the giant corporations. And there are, you know, many proposals. My friend Garl Perowitz had an article in the New York Times where he pointed out that the old Chicago school economists, very conservative, you know, would have none of this too big to fail. You know, if they're too big to fail, it's time to nationalize them. And that's basically was, you know, if you can't regulate in effect and have real competition, you know, you shouldn't let these. And another approach would be to apply the concept of public utility regulation, which, you know, basically passes judgment on investment decisions in the energy sector for a lot of utilities, and apply that concept more broadly to other sectors of the economy that are, you know, need tighter regulation and tighter democratic supervision. So I think the core concept is economic democracy. Hmm. How do we get more democratic control both on the workplace with worker ownership and other types of co-ops, and how do we get more democratic control over big investment decisions in the economy? Right now, we are severely over-investing in things that have high financial return relative to under-investing in things that have a high social and environmental return. Mm-hmm. And only government can make the difference, and that's why we've got to get in there and save our government before it's too late, save our democracy.
Hear, hear to that. My guest today has been Gus Speth. He's the author of America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. Gus Speth, it's wonderful to meet you and to talk with you.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate this opportunity.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.